Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Hi, everybody. I'm once again fiddling with my knobs.
I wish he wouldn't do that in public.
It happens. I have to sometimes. There's just no easy way about it. I just have to fiddle with my knobs.
Well, while you're fiddling with your knobs, how about I do the Amazon promo?
You go right ahead and do that.
All right. If you go to 1201beyond.com, and you'll see there's links all over there or banners.
Fiddle. Go ahead. Can I do the promo without
you?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
If you go there, and for the UK or pretty much most of Europe, you can click on the Amazon UK link.
Yeah.
It costs you nothing. And it helps us out a little bit, just if you're going to shop normally. Amazon US, same thing. And I think that works for Canada, not 100%.
I believe
on that
it does. I think it covers. I think it's
continental US,
yeah,
or not
US
continental, the continent, more or less.
I think it covers the US and Canada.
Okay, fair.
Because
enough.
I mean, they got to ship things to Alaska, and that's in the US.
You basically have to go through Canada to get there. So
that's right.
So go to 1201beyond.com, use the Amazon links if you're going to be shopping anyway. It doesn't cost you anything, and it helps us out a little bit.
Clear your cookies
and turn off your ad blocker. Unlike Scott.
Yeah, because
He yells when he doesn't see the ads, and then, your ad blocker off?
Shut up.
Yes.
It is now, and there they are.
All right, what I want to talk about tonight is not the first time, you know, like comic books, books, movies, etc., went adult. The first adult thing you encountered in these given mediums, like the first thing when you really went, oh shit, this is dirty, when you were a kid.
The first adult thing I encountered was my dad's Playboys in his office.
So your first adult magazine was Playboy.
I kid you, it really was. He used to, it was so funny because you would see this long line of National Geographics. My parents subscribed to National Geographic
for a long time.
And so you would see all these collections and you would see encyclopedias. And then it just every now and then you'd find a volume of encyclopedias that spread a little bit further apart than it should be. And there was my dad's Playboys. and he kept them in his office.
Maybe he was reading them for the articles.
No.
Well, I'm just saying that... Okay, you know how guys used to always use that as an excuse?
Right.
That's actually a valid excuse. I go through those old Playboys from the 70s and 80s. The tits, I don't even notice them anymore. Maybe I've been so desensitized from the internet. I buy the old issues for the stories by Ray Bradbury, articles by Stephen King and Hunter S. Thompson and shit.
Yeah,
I buy them for the articles.
Now it's very much, with the prevalence of free porn on the internet, why bother going out and getting Playboy, too? Because, you know, if you like Taiwanese nurses that enjoy scat play and wearing latex, you can find that on the internet. And so what's the point of Playboy, which really is pretty tame?
Right, but I'm not being facetious when I say this, it's got a lot of good articles.
It really does.
I can't tell you how many what-the-fuck stories in the Ed Glaser era I got out of a Playboy.
I believe it.
So, I mean, really, it does. Now, my first adult magazine was a Hustler, so it was a little more sleazy than yours. Little less articles at the time. So, mine was a Hustler.
My friend used to cut up Hustlers. He used to cut the pictures out, and he kept a drawer full of pictures. And his excuse was he was using them to study life drawing.
Yeah.
And so, and I said, well, great, show me your drawings. I don't have any.
Well, okay, I maybe it wasn't a Hustler. My dad was also a big Jugs. He was a Jugs subscriber, so probably might have been a Jugs issue too.
See, I really didn't get exposed to the adult magazines that are not, you know, because there was Playboy, Penthouse, and Hustler. Those are the big three.
Yep.
And then, you know, popping up and down in business is where you had things like Wii and Jugs and some of the weird ones like Big Beautiful Super Boobs or something like
that.
That's
pretty much what Jugs was.
Well, no, because Jugs had like regular I can't use regular. They had skinnier women with gigantic, enormous. Really? No.
Jugs. Okay, this isn't even part of the topic, but Jugs has a funny history.
Okay.
Now, keep in mind, I like big girls. I've
yes,
admitted
you do.
That, okay?
Yes, you do.
So that's why I kind of gravitate towards the Jugs, because I like girls with meat on them. Jugs was actually run by gay men who thought it would be funny to put in what they thought were the most unattractive women with just really big boobs, and then they were floored when they found out that it was selling on levels of almost Hustler. That's what men want. Men want a woman that looked like a regular woman,
yeah,
not like a model. And that's what Jugs catered to. Big boobed, normal looking women.
See, and I like
big girls.
Yeah, I like the amateur stuff. When I worked at the adult bookstore, Hustler always had that beaver hunt.
Yep, they still do, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, that was one of my favorite sections. I like the amateur stuff.
They have whole issues with that. But, okay, adult magazines are not our topic.
Okay, so aside from adult magazines, you're talking specifically adult, say, comics.
Let's leave comics out for now because
we
have an interview later, so that'll tie into that.
Okay.
Right now, what was your first? And now, your definition of adult and mine might differ here. Your first adult video game that you encountered.
Gosh.
Now, adult doesn't necessarily mean sex in this context.
Right.
Because there are gory as shit games that were out at the time. Like Splatterhouse, some people would consider an adult game because it was gory as fuck and, you know, you cut open a belly
right.
and aborted fetuses attacked you and stuff.
Right.
That's adult. It's just, so it doesn't necessarily mean sexual or dirty.
Well, then I'll give you two answers.
Okay.
I'll give you the one, which is the sexual answer, which was a horrible, horrible game.
Which was?
Custer's Revenge.
Oh, Atari 2600.
Yep. And Dad picked it up from the shop on a whim because he saw the box and he thought it would be funny, you know.
Yeah, that was an $80 funny.
And then we played it like twice and it went back on the shelf and that was that.
If you still have it, that thing's worth a lot of money, by the way, nowadays.
It's probably stuffed in a box in a basement.
An original
somewhere.
Card of that, you can probably get $300-$400 for that now.
Yeah,
especially if you got the box and the instructions.
I'll have to find out because Dad may very well have that. Otherwise.
Okay, then your first non-sexual adult video game.
You hit it on the nose. There used to be a little nerd shop, a little D&D shop at Ball State called Wizard's Keep.
Okay.
And you went in, you went downstairs, and this guy had swords on the wall, and he had the miniatures to paint, and he had the books, and, you know, it was a nerd shop.
And fantasy always did kind of have the big-boobed naked woman
exactly,
you had to rescue.
Exactly. And if you went into his back room, he had one pinball machine, and I forget which pinball machine it was, but it wasn't a very good one. But he also had Outrun, the sit-down move version, and then a stand-up cabinet of Splatterhouse. And that was the first thing where I looked at it and I went, yes, this belongs in a basement in a dark corner.
It's fucking gory as shit.
Because it's gory as all get out. And yeah, like you said, you're attacked by aborted fetuses and such. And that was always a big thrill with me and my friend David. We'd go there on lunch at school and go down and throw a couple of quarters in the Splatterhouse machine.
See, I can't really nail down what mine would be because I always sought out that kind of stuff. So I don't have a clear enough memory to go, this was my first, you know, on either of those counts. So I'm going to kind of have to defer that one on my personal, because I can't nail down what the first would be. But
now,
I did play a lot of them gore games and, the games that look little pixelated titties.
Yeah, and even moving beyond gore and pixelated boobs and such, which, okay, even back when we had the Apple IIe, I forget what they were. It was along the same lines as Leisure Suit Larry.
Oh, yeah, there was a whole bunch of those.
Yeah, there were a whole bunch of those, but I'm talking the original. And there was a text adventure that I remember that Mom got for me because she didn't realize what it was. But I had the original text adventure version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Had boobies?
No. No. I had that, and I played it a lot, and Mom wanted to encourage me to read. So she went out and she got this text adventure called Leather Goddesses of Phobos.
I'm going to have to look that up. Leather Goddesses of Phobos. That's a great title, by the way.
Yes.
It's a really good title.
It was a very, very sexy.
Did it have leather goddesses adventure from Phobos in it?
Yes, it did.
Then there, it lived up to its title.
That's right.
Okay, then what would be your first encounter with adult books? Again, both sexual and just adult in themes and whatnot.
Sure. That would be my friend Derek running White Rabbit Books. As I got older, for some reason, my family got more and more conservative.
Okay.
So by the time I hit my teen years and I was starting to get interested in reading an adult theme to a book that wasn't assigned by my
high school, 1984 or something.
Well, that wasn't assigned by my high school teacher. You know, like Paradise Lost or Animal Farm or stuff like that. Then my parents becoming more and more conservative, it got really difficult for me to even buy regular literature.
Okay.
Thank God for my friend Derek, who was within walking distance from my school. And
what did he give you?
You name it. He ran a used bookstore, and he had every kind of science fiction that you could possibly imagine. He had everything from Harlequin romances to books on the occult to some used textbooks to some great works of literature bound in leather and whatnot for $3 for the book and stuff like that. And on top of all of that, and introducing me to some science fiction that I kind of got into, on top of that, he has an entire corner of his store dedicated to adult material, meaning spank mags and stuff like that.
There's also something else that we have to wrap into this. Those that are too young probably won't remember the actual sex books where it was just all text.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, he thrust his member into her juicy loins and then he shot his, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, it's certainly still around today in the form of 50 Shades of Grey, and also in the Harlequin romances are basically just,
but they're not, those aren't hardcore though.
Some of them
I don't read Harlequin romance. Maybe you do. I don't know.
I did because I sold them. And to tell you the truth, they are a quick, easy, simple read. And I was dating a
bored
girl.
Out of your mind.
I was bored out of my mind. I was also dating a girl named Melanie at the time, and Melanie was really into the hardcore. You know, the any frickin' book you can imagine with Fabio on the cover. You know, she was into that classic big romance and the
pirate with the blow-dried hair.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know.
Because that's always what it was. My mom always had those in the bathroom, so you'd always find one next to the toilet.
Oh, yeah.
So I'd always see the cover, and it was always, why does the pirate have done-up hair?
Exactly.
It's like, that just seems, you know, stupid for the pirate, but okay.
Yeah. So she was into those, and I read those, of course. I was also introduced to Anne Rice's Beauty series.
You know how much I hate Anne Rice.
Love it or hate it, it's basically hardcore porn in printed page with that Anne Rice vampire flair.
Yeah.
I am Anne Rice. I will write flowery and make all of my characters hate
and
the
I will
world.
I will overly describe everything because I get paid by the fucking word.
Yes, boy. Howdy, did she.
I'll spend 3 paragraphs describing the curtains because I get paid by the word. No, she does. That's why she overly describes everything.
I know.
So mine, the sex one, I can't really nail down because it was, you know, I used to read those sex, you know, text ones all the time. Whenever my dad would go to the liquor store, they sold those. So I'd always, you know, read a chapter here, chapter there kind of thing.
Did you ever see any of those adult choose-your-own-adventure books?
No, I don't believe I've
encountered
those. Because
you remember the boom of
got a whole bunch. I've still got a bunch from my childhood.
I love the choose-your-own-adventure books. Well,
except when they backed you into a corner and you're like, God damn it, I can't remember what page I have to go back to start this, you know, to go back 3 chapters.
I always had post-it
notes. You had notes?
I had
you
post-it
suck.
Notes. I had post-it notes. I'd just stick them on the
you
page.
You paranoid fuck.
but
That's cheating.
They had I forget what publishing house did it. I want to say Penguin, but that's probably wrong. But yeah, they had you know, adult versions of Choose Your Own Adventure with grown-up themes and grown-up decisions, and they were decent books, and they of course had the ones that the kids read, but they also had some of the adult ones. Again, thank you, Derek, for introducing me, and I apologize.
He's drinking milk.
Hiccuping like you wouldn't believe.
Well, mine for non-sexual, even though there is sex in them, and I know this is going to seem kind of tame, but it would be... And those of you who haven't read the early stuff, especially when he was still Richard Bachman, read those Bachman books. A lot of adult themes, a lot of sex.
A Dark Tower.
Those didn't come till later, though.
Right.
But these are early 80s. Or Clive Barker, the original Books of Blood stuff. A lot of sex, a lot of gore. So you being not really a comic book guy, did you ever encounter the adult comic books? Or
oh, yes.
You not being a comic guy, just...
Oh, no. There is one line of adult comics that held my interest. And again, thank you, Derek. He had tons and tons of issues of Heavy Metal.
That was actually my first encounter, too, was Heavy Metal.
And, you know, of course you open the page and you're like, boobies. Really well-drawn boobies.
See, okay, Heavy Metal has this thing that is not going to make sense the way I say it. But if you think about it, and those of you go back and read those first 10 years of Heavy Metal, and it will make sense. They had the perfect mix of stoner humor.
Yep.
And intelligent science fiction. Those two things shouldn't go together, but they tended to work in Heavy Metal, didn't it?
If you know your audience.
But I'm just saying,
the movie did have a car in space, and that was pretty awesome, dude.
But you get what I'm saying, how
yeah.
stoner humor and intelligent science fiction should not work together.
Right.
But Heavy Metal made them work.
But, you
somehow.
Know, Heavy Metal had this stuff for when you're stoned and reading it, and you found it hilarious. And then you would come down and you wanted some intellectual stimulation, because pot does that to you. For some reason, I'm one of those people that, it's hilarious. Last time I got high was all the way back in college, so late 90s.
Okay.
And I have this notebook filled with...
Ramblings?
Rambling scrawlings, because, you know, you smoke weed and you're the most brilliant person in the world, and everything you come up with is this... unbelievable epiphany that then makes you laugh for 20 minutes. and I have this notebook to remind me, because I read through it and I'm like, I have no idea what I was talking about.
Well, another one for me and my generation was Faust. Not like the classic tale,
okay.
But the 1986 comic published by North Star, written by David Quinn, drawn by Tim Vigil. Okay, that was the first time I saw gore and cum shots and people getting their penises cut off and people being eviscerated and whatnot.
Before you continue, my first adult-themed comic that really made an impact on me, and there were two. The first one is Mouse.
M-A-U-S for those
M-A-U-S for those that are curious. And that, of course, deals with...
Nazi Germany.
Nazi Germany and
cats and with cats and mice. Cats as Nazis and mice as
Jews.
Jews. Yeah. I said Germans, but yeah. Well, they're still Germans.
There. I was going to say there are some... But anyway, cats as Nazis, mice as that. And that was, again, kind of traumatic when you're used to the Donald Duck comics, and then somebody gives you a copy of Mouse.
Yeah, well, you should see the unauthorized books of Mickey Mouse. Those early Mickey Mouse comic strips where he, you know, like machine guns down people in the kneecaps and stuff like that. All the ones Walt refused to ever let be reprinted.
And the other one that hit me and really hit me in college is that comics can be funny and adult funny as well as kid funny was Johnny the Homicidal Maniac.
That one never did anything for me. I've read it, but...
Yeah, for those curious, it's by Jonan Vasquez, who's known for Invader Zim.
Yeah, very much. You can see the style.
Oh, yeah.
But so I interviewed David Quinn, the writer of Faust.
Okay.
And asked him about like the impact and, you know, what they were thinking and whatnot. Now, Faust is, I know this is going to seem bad, 15 issues. The 15th issue comes out at the end of this year. Started in 1986.
Goodness.
So gracious. A long lead time between, like North Star went out of business after like issue 8. So then there was a long 3 or 4 year gap before issue 9 came out when they found a new publisher and things. And it's been a long road, but we're finally going to get closure to the Love of the Damned story at the end of this year.
Are we going to get an anthology?
They are actually re-releasing all of the stuff in trade paperbacks.
Or a really good graphic novel.
I'm going to punch you.
Okay.
So listen to my interview with David Quinn, and then Scott and I will be back after this.
First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak to me.
My pleasure. I appreciate it. We're having a good time finding all the new ways we can to tell people what Tim Vigil and I are doing with Faust this year. So this is a great opportunity for us too.
Before we get into that, and I do want to talk about all the stuff you guys are doing now, let's talk about how Faust started off back in the early days of North Star Comics. How did you guys first hook up with North Star, or did you have Faust prior to going to North Star?
The Faust was very, very different prior to North Star. Let me just back up just a second for anyone who wasn't paying attention, you know, 25, 26 years ago, and set that scene. There was a black and white boom around the time of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Cerebus and a few other black and white comics that made it suddenly very attractive to publishers to put out black and white comics. All of a sudden, black and white comics had gone from something that was seen as kind of amateurish and Bush League and undesirable and too underground by comic shops, and suddenly it was seen as something that was just the epitome of the latest creative wave and the latest collectible wave. So that was what happened the year Tim Vigil happened to get into comics with a little company called Silverworth in California. Fortunately for him, suddenly he went from being a hardworking fan artist to a very collectible young black and white artists in these black and white comics. And Independence had a splash. I was a playwright at the time, reading comics, but not really writing them. And a friend of ours said, you know, I want to publish a comic like Tim. I'd love for him to work with a writer. Could you guys work together once you guys meet? So we met in Brooklyn and I helped him work on something that was called Omega. We published it for 3 issues as Omen through North Star. I'm kind of merging 2 different publishers together that were working with us at the time. We weren't yet publishing ourselves. We were working with one person in Brooklyn who'd been backing us and put out 1 issue, and another person out in Chicago who had seen that issue and wanted to publish us. That was North Star. Later, I would become friends with Hart Fisher, not realizing that he was sort of kind of hanging out and slash working with North Star. At the time, we were all so young, and so like 1 foot in fandom, but the other foot in trying to produce our own work, that everyone I mentioned was like also young, still like college age, that we could just do all these things, try all these things very spontaneously, and the market was forgiving because they were buying these black and white comics like crazy. Luckily, that lasted for a few years, which really carried North Star to an early success. And they branched out and did a lot of other things. And if they hadn't made some business mistakes, not paid us, we would have probably stayed working with North Star forever. What do you need, hon? Yeah, you have pencils in the kitchen, honey. Let's go get them. Yes, you can tell I'm a little older now, and I got a 6-year-old here, and yeah, that's.
She needs pencils.
But she's a good girl, so she'll go get her pencil and sweet. Love ya. Yep. So anyway, I just destroyed any credit I have with underground. No, that's my life. That's life. I just always make that joke, you know. You know, I may have created Faust with Tim Vigil, but We're just normal guys at the end of the day, and I have a six-year-old kid.
Speaking of North Star, I used to buy a whole lot of North Star stuff. That's the real, when I first branched out of Marvel and DC,
yeah.
North Star was where I went. I was buying Slash and Splatter and Faust and their Leatherface book and all that stuff. Whatever, they just seemed to have vanished at one point. You said bad business decisions?
I think it was the way a lot of people went at the time. You probably noticed that a lot of other things that you read at the time don't exist anymore either and didn't last very long. A little bit later, Image would come along, and Image still exists, but it's had to change very much in order to survive through the decades. So, I mean, at the time, I think a young guy named Dan Madsen, like pretty young, younger than me, assembled a team. I mentioned Hart Fisher, Mort Castle was his editor. And I'm going to forget a few names, but there was Mark Bernal and a lot of other people. Tim Vigil, of course, probably the best known artist he was working with. I think Joe Vigil, Tim's brother, came along and did some stuff for them, too. He chose a lot of interesting people and made a big splash. I wasn't real intimate with the business in the beginning, which kind of explains why we eventually went self-publishing, and I became very intimate with the business. So I don't know what went wrong. Because the print runs were huge, the reprints were huge, the book was translated into, I mean, I'm talking about Faust now because I don't know all the books. Faust was translated into several other languages, you know, some legitimate and some not international editions. And there was good business to be made in for a little while in these black and white comics. And then like all booms, there came the bust. People that could make a book about adjective, animal.
Oh, yes, the funny, you know, the funny the animal boom, yes.
But we're gone, and black and whites were gone. People that had a property that might have been sustainable, such as Faust, and, you know, maybe there were others. So I think I'm getting confused with Avatar. I'm not going to mention Avatar properties. That's another story for a later year. But
when North Star did go bust, you ended up taking Faust over to Rebel, correct?
We did. Rebel was the name that Tim had always used for his art initiative. I helped him set it up to be not just a one-man art production house, but a two-man team with him running production and art and me running writing and commercialization and communication. With hard work, it's not impossible to do. Look at all the people that have self-published successfully. We were part of that late 80s, early 90s wave that kind of still has reverberations to this day with people talking about, can't do it the way I want to do it, sell enough to make a success at Image, I'll do it myself.
I told you this on the phone. When I first started buying Faust, it was long before I was legally able to do so, since Faust was a very adults-only title. I was buying Faust when I was like 14.
Well, I'm sure you could probably handle it, right?
Yes, I loved it.
There's a reason it's not for kids, and we've always said it's not for kids. You put it right on it. But, you know, if you're taking the time to find it and actually read it, I'm sure you can handle it.
Yeah.
Now, I've got a child myself, so I think about that carefully, and I keep things out of her hands, too, and I think that's the way it should be. But, you know, at the same time, when she's mature enough to handle something, she's going to seek it out, and hopefully she'll be ready for it.
I mean, I still have an old Faust t-shirt that doesn't fit anymore because it was something I had in high school that I treasure it because I'm never going to run across another one of those again.
Oh, yeah.
I even have the hologram trading card you guys put out back in like 90 or 91.
Oh, wow. I don't even know if I have any of those.
I have one of those still, autographed by Tim.
Well, hang on to this stuff. You know, it's fun. And I appreciate you telling me what you're telling me and the emotions that it has for you, and fortunate that there's a lot of people that have told me that over the last few years, because it keeps them reading. And hopefully when I've got something, they include my stuff in that reading.
When the Faust movie came out, which I'll ask you more about in a second, but did you feel that people were being very disingenuous to the comic when they constantly compared the movie to Spawn?
Fortunately, by the time the movie came out, we were a decade older than when we first started, and we had a little life under our belts, so to speak. I mean, so we could understand that people speak without knowing what they don't know and what they don't know that they don't know. And, you know, when they talk about Bonn, I mean, they don't really realize that Bonn comes from a tradition and, you know, Faust is also part of it. And maybe they never heard of the Faust legend. So it's not even just Quinn and Vigil's Faust they're ignorant of. It's the fact that there's a Faust legend, which is basically the Bonn story too. I interviewed Pat McFarlane at a couple comic conventions, the Great Eastern Conventions, all around the States and in Canada and even in London in the 90s. And he wasn't know much about any tradition of literature. He was into some comics and he was into some hockey. And, you know, so I don't think he was, you know.
Well, no, I mean more like.
You understand what I'm saying? I don't think he was, like, taking our book as his template.
Well, right. I wasn't blaming McFarlane. I'm blaming the movie reviewers. Almost every review I saw said this thing is a Spawn ripoff, and I just got so irritated at that, that it's like, you people, you know, if you're going to review a movie, get the fucking facts straight. This thing is not a Spawn ripoff in any way, and I got irritated at that. You having written it, I'm sure that irritated you a little bit, too.
Man, well, maybe the first couple of times. But like I said, you know, we were a little older by then, and you realize people don't know anything.
No,
they just don't.
I know that. Now, how did the movie come about?
The movie had a real long history, and I won't bore you. I'll try to be succinct. Stuart Gordon, who directed Honey, I Shrunk the Kids and was a theater director before that, was a very interesting filmmaker, and a filmmaker very interesting to go off outside the box, off the road, off the page, whatever you want to call it. He met us and wanted to, you know, produce Faust the movie. And he loved the comic, and he loved what we did, and he was willing to go out there and do it. And we worked for our script for a while with him, and he never got his funding. Unfortunately, Brian Yuzna was a friend of his. They'd worked together. Brian's the director, most famously probably of Reanimator, but he's done a lot of other stuff. Brian had a skill for setting up, I think he still has it to this day, because the last I heard he was in Indonesia still doing this. His skill was setting up these production companies for, you know, investors and film companies that could make slates of interesting offbeat stuff. And so he was going to be able to make what, in a way that nobody in Hollywood could make, by making it in Barcelona with the international cast, Spanish and international funding, and distribute it throughout the world. Now, we never had a theatrical release in the States, but it had theatrical releases all over the world and, you know, DVDs here. So that was the way he was able to set it up. So I hope that answers your question. That's the how.
Well, what did you think of the final product? Because I know, I thought Andrew Divoff was perfectly cast as M. I thought Andrew Divoff was absolutely amazing in the movie. I did have one major criticism, but that was just the actress they got to play Claire. I thought her line delivery was porno movie quality.
You know, did you like Jeffrey Combs? He's pretty awesome.
I love Jeffrey Combs. Jeffrey Combs is awesome in anything.
Yeah. I love being able to meet those guys and work with those guys a little bit. Tim and I were involved as far as meeting with Brian, and I wrote a script. But the script process was eventually taken out of my hands while they were shooting. We weren't around then. I usually tell people that I'm proud that we got it made, and I love parts of it a lot. I think it's pretty awesome for the first half hour or so. I think it kind of looks like they ran out of time and money, so I try to be charitable about that. I don't, like, take that as, like, oh, somebody ruined something I did. No, I mean, they tried to do the best they could with what they had, you know, and if it looks a little bit like maybe they could have recast some parts or, you know, they ran out of money at the end, well, they made a lot of people happy. It's shown all over the place. So, you know, it's compromised like everything else, but it's had a healthy life. I'm meeting people all the time that, get this, I mean, have no idea that it was ever a comic book before the movie.
Well, and even before this, the version with Andrew Divoff and Jeffrey Combs, you tried earlier in the 90s to get a movie made. I've got an old Femme Fatales issue with, I can't remember which Scream Queen it is, dressed up as Claire on the cover, And it said that was to try to look for funding. Was that the Stuart Gordon funding that was being looked at that point?
That would have been with Stuart Gordon and as director, and that was Brink Stevens, who wasn't actually cast in it, but she was a friend of ours, and she was interested in helping us, and she was interested in having that film, that picture as a product that she could sell.
And she looked dead on as Claire.
Yeah,
too.
She's great.
She was dead on as Claire.
Martin, a sexy lady, and still is. And that was fun for her and fun for us.
Now, Faust has a legacy with you guys that I know people who were not even alive during the first print run that have read it. Have you guys had a lot of the legacy follow your? What is the Faust legacy to you?
It's extremely gratifying that we touched a nerve in so many people, and that, like you say, there's people that if they saw me, they'd say, "Oh, look, that's somebody's boring old dad." But if they read Faust, they might think, "Wow, this is a very interesting mind behind this," and I'd love to do something like this myself. The legacy for me probably lives the biggest with the people I meet all the time who are like you. They said, I read it when I was 14, wanted to be a filmmaker, and now I am. Or read it when I was 14, wanted to write comics, that's what I'm doing now. You know, the people that we've just inspired to be other do-it-yourselfer punk rock artists, that's the legacy.
Well, speaking of punk rock, I noticed, and since this is an art thing, maybe, I don't know if you know about this, but I'm sure you and Tim were together on this. I noticed a lot of the zombies and stuff that pop up in the book are wearing Misfit t-shirts and Danzig t-shirts and Dead Kennedys t-shirts. I'm going to guess you're a punk fan.
Oh, yeah, in a big way. And Tim and I are both music fans in a broader sense, too. We've shared a lot of music over the years. We've put songs into the books. In fact, I'm writing a piece about that for one of the final text page, is one of the final issues. But I'll go more into that when I write that piece. But I came from music before Faust. I was performing music and writing plays in New York. I mentioned the playwriting because that's sort of where the writing training came from. But I think having a punk rock band in New York was an equal creative seed for some of the feelings of Faust. And when Warren Ellis wrote about Faust one time, he mentioned the music first. Like, it was obviously very, very loud in our minds when we were working on the issues. And we've tried to sustain that through it, you know. Some of the most early issues are very anarchic and crazy because that's where John Jasper's head is at the time. So that was a good way to translate that to paper. And then, you know, like I said, Tim and I are both fans of all kinds of music. If you have time, I'll tell you this one thing that's kind of funny. The only thing that, I mean, I had a punk band. I still have a punk band to this day, actually, although my punk band now is virtual. We don't play together. We play by sharing tapes and stuff back and forth, and we're developing a project that is basically the zombie version of the Gorillaz, if you know who I mean.
I believe I do.
Yeah, the outfit that is a sort of a virtual band fronted by cartoons, and they never show themselves. Tim Vigil's doing some of the zombie art. This is going to be the front of this. And we are called the Romeros after George Romero. The music stuff that's funny for me is Tim and I also, you mentioned Danzig, Tim and I also both worked for Danzig's company. Me doing some ghostwriting that was eventually kind of rewritten by him and published as his writing. That was our deal, so that was fine with me. I'm not saying anything was not on the up and up about it. He was one of the people that actually hired me to do something and then paid me, which is a whole different story in itself. Just a war to getting paid in these independents. Danzig's always been a friend at conventions, and Tim's also done work for him, and Tim's brother has also done work for him, and it's a small world. But sometimes when musicians who hand us their work because they're making just the darkest and most screaming death metal music there is. And while I'm intensely proud that they will be inspired by Faust and write something based on it and give it to us, at the same time, my listening to death metal personally these days is like 1% of my listening. So I have to be very respectful to them and very polite, but actually I don't live that screaming 24/7.
The book itself, how did it change? Because of the long lead time sometimes between issues, and especially between the North Star and the Rebel publications. I noticed the style of the writing and the art sort of change. Like you pointed out, it was more chaotic in the beginning. Did you have the whole story plotted out right away, or were you making it up as the story went along? You kind of went where the story seemed likely to go.
Now, that's a smart question, because the answer is both, and you've sensed it just from the way you read it. We talked through the story at an early, early date, and it was easy to do so because we saw each other a lot. We signed together at conventions in the 90s, monthly, sometimes weekly. And we traveled in 1990 to 12 to 14 different states. I don't think I went on all of them, but Tim sure did. I mean, Tim is a road warrior. He's out there signing and sketching. He's not a huge public speaker, but he's a very thoughtful artist. So he'll chat with people and sketch for people and do a long list of sketches and do signatures for anyone who wants them, and he'll be out there. So we had a lot of time on the road together. We did a European tour in 97, and the other tour of the States was back in 90. So we had a lot of time to go through the story in the 90s. So we've known the general shape. We'll talk about what would be in an issue, and then I'd go write it, and then he'd draw it. And it would keep changing until the last minute, because we'd keep changing each other. We'd keep making suggestions. What happens on the page in his art, or about what happens in the dialogue and captions in my writing. We'd work it to the end. Sometimes we even probably would have written about this. Sometimes I think we'd probably overwork it a little bit. It did take us a long time to get done. But the long wait in between issues began kind of as a result of we were victims of our own success. People really loved the incredibly detailed work Tim would do, so he'd spend more time on it to make sure that there weren't any panels that he'd let go before they were really done in his eye. I started writing full time. I let go of trying to be a New York playwright and didn't have a band at the time and was working on comics full time, and other people started asking me to write comics for them. So, you know, in a way, in the 90s, we were a little bit of a victim of our success and the boom in comics. So that slowed us down. So, yeah, you notice the transition from the early, very hectic, I mean, obviously inspired, but very hectic issues to a more polished and refined self-publishing where we actually were able to proofread everything. One of my regrets now, looking back, is not so much that North Star kept our money, but, you know, just that they wouldn't proofread things, you know, that they put lettering mistakes in even though they had an editor. We haven't worked with an editor since we've been self-publishing. We've been our own editors, so any mistakes now are on us, but we really try to fix them all, whether it's a little thing in the art or you know.
A spelling mistake.
A casual lettering mistake that's so easy to happen. You know, even when I worked for publishers like Marvel, DC, Top Cow, Dark Horse, you know, the first time you see lettering, it's very common to have a mistake on every page, and that doesn't mean the letterer is not doing his or her job. It just means, you know, that's how fast it's going, you know, and this is going to be a mistake that has to be fixed by an editor.
You guys are reprinting everything, or what are you guys all doing now? You said you've got a bunch of new stuff coming out.
Last week, we shipped the first two trades called the Faust Communion 1 and the Faust Communion 2, and collectively, these thin little paperbacks collect with some, you know, background material and extra writing, extra art. They collect the first six issues. And these are still the first prints of these trades that came out in the last decade. Next month is another re-release, which is the third communion, collecting 7 through 9. Oh, there's some very choice issues. And then we're up through issue 12 in a fourth and new communion collection next month, too. Putting that together right now with an essay in the back and a new cover by Tim. Actually, you know, it's a kind of an old reworked cover, but it's a new piece that's never been seen, you know, in print. On my blog, In Walked Quinn, I talk about them, so people have questions. It's easy to find the answers in your comic shop.
So, one of the things I thought was really funny was you heard me tell him that since Faust came out in 86. How old were we in 86?
I was 11, yeah.
And it's an adults-only book. So I told him, I've been reading this book since longer than I was legally able to do so, which I think is kind of funny.
I've been doing a lot of things since for longer than I've been legally able to do so.
So I guess one thing I want to ask the audience is, what was your first encounter with adult material in your given medium? In video games, in books, in comic books, even in movies. What was your first adult movie that you can remember? And you don't have to having seen the entire movie, because let's face it, you know, when you're 12 and jerking off, you only need 30, 40 seconds of boob to get off to that. So you don't need a whole movie for that at that point.
You want to talk about a video game. I remember the first one that really, really riled my mom up. That dad bought a copy of it on shareware and then ended up buying the full experience, if you will, was Duke Nukem 3D.
Yeah. I can see that, because you're blowing people up and boobies.
Well, you're blowing people up in boobies, and I remember distinctly, my mom came into the office where the computer was, and I was sitting there playing with a couple of my friends, playing the computer game with a couple of my friends, not, you know, playing with a couple of my friends.
I don't think you needed to specify that, but fair enough.
But I remember we were playing with a couple of my friends, Mom came into the office to, I don't know, give us milk and cookies or something like that. But it just happened as my next door neighbor handed, you know, the 50 to the stripper, and she doffed her top and flashed her little square
ultra pixelated boobies.
Ultra pixelated square nipple boobies. And that was not a good day in the Murray household.
Did you get your ass kicked, literally or figuratively?
Well, they never really, you know, did much in the way of ass kicking, but all my friends got sent home, and I had to sit through lecture upon lecture, and I was grounded for a couple of weeks.
How old were you at this point?
I don't remember. I was old enough that it shouldn't have been as big of a production as
it
was.
Did you ever get caught with some of your dad's magazines?
Oh, yeah.
'Cause I remember, you know, I didn't think he'd notice. He had such a huge stack if I took a couple and kept them. Apparently he did.
Yeah.
Apparently he noticed.
Yep.
And I don't know if he did this to humiliate me, but he sent my mom to find them. That's even more humiliating than your dad catching you, is your mom catching you.
See,
you know?
I was going to say, if my dad caught me, which he did once, you know, that...
It's not as humiliating, is it?
Yeah, it's not that bad, and dad doesn't make a big... He really doesn't make a big production about
it. Because he understands
that
he did it too, you know, to his dad probably.
Well, I know what it's like. And then, but God, if mom caught you, oh, the world was ending.
Yeah.
Mom walked in on me and a girlfriend once too. That was.
How far?
Oh.
All the way?
Oh, I was finishing.
Ah.
So.
Must have been a weird O-face. Never mind, I don't want to go there.
You don't want to go there,
no.
But...
Oh, okay, did you ever have to... Now, again, this goes... This goes back to a day before you could just get shit shipped over the internet and whatnot.
Right,
Okay, remember when I wrote my Hustler article and I was trying to get everybody to buy it?
Right.
And there were, like Tanner, our listener Tanner, he... underage. He's like, I can't find anyone to buy me a Hustler. Now I know what it's like to have tried to get porn in the 1980s at this age. And it's like, yes, that's what it was like.
Now
because,
you know our pain.
Yeah, because no one will ship to him because he's a minor.
I always loved the seniors in high school. They were wonderful.
Well, I remember having to talk my mom into buying me like the first Cannibal Corpse album.
Mm-hmm.
Because which would be butchered at birth, because the record store had a strict, we will not sell this to anyone under 18. Because for those that don't know, that was an intensely controversial album, was banned in some counties. So I had to talk my mom, you know, I'll be good and I'll do this and I'll do the dishes all month if you just buy this for me, please. You know, so I had to have that's kind of embarrassing. You have to have your mom buy you a record.
I remember buying the very first Grand Theft Auto. the top down.
The one where you, yeah, the yeah, one that's the, not even recognizable with what today's Grand Theft Auto
to,
is.
Compared to Vice City onwards. But yeah, I remember buying the very first Grand Theft Auto for a friend of mine because he was 17.
And they wouldn't sell it to him?
And they wouldn't sell it to him.
Wow. Because, see, I remember there was one music store where I lived that would always card you and give you shit, you know, if it had the explicit lyrics sticker sure. on it. And then there was another one that just kind of like, if you get caught, I didn't sell this to you.
Exactly.
So we always had that one cool one and then that one bad one. But the cool one was always more expensive, so you tried not to go there unless you had to because they had like a probably 10 to 15% markup over what the chain store
yep.
had. So it's, well, the cassette's $15 or it's $20. When you're working on an allowance and you don't, you know, you I don't have a job, that's a big exactly. decision you got to make there, because that's a pizza with your friends on Friday night or not.
Exactly. It's the same reason why my friends and I used to go to a certain store in Muncie, and growing up a smoker, you'll always know this store will card you, this store will not. This store, and you want to talk about things that you haven't seen since the early 90s, this store used to keep their cigarettes out on the counter, just lined up in packs, and you would just take the packs
you want. Yeah,
you
said you used
to
steal it.
Just reach up and, you know, could I see the thing on that back wall? Where? No, over there. Well, up here? No, I was, you know, grab stuff.
Oh, so. Hell, speaking of that, I remember when the bowling alley in Sturgeon Bay got busted because teenagers were coming in and bowling, and I'm making air quotes, and then they would use the cigarette machine in the bar to sure. get their smokes
sure.
because the bar wasn't monitoring the cigarette machine close enough. Do you even see cigarette machines anymore? As a non-smoker, seriously, is that still a thing?
I have seen one in all of Northeast Wisconsin. Actually, no. I will tell you, there are places where there are cigarette machines. They are casinos.
Okay.
That's the only place I've ever seen a cigarette machine. And cigarettes at the casino, $8 a pack, which is absolutely ridiculous.
Well, okay, since we're running out of time, I want to ask you, what did you ever do this when you'd go to the bookstore? You know, they always have the kind of higher rack for the adult section.
Oh, yes.
And at least at the bookstores I went to, for whatever reason, the adult section was always right above, like, Newsweek and Time and stuff like that.
Oh,
so
yes.
The political and news section. Did you always pretend to read Time, but your eyes were up at Hustler and Playboy?
Oh, yes.
You know, you'd look and the clerk's not looking, so you'd flip through some pages of the Hustler. Or what.
See,
this is before they polybagged everything.
I also saw it as not a big deal because, again, back in the 80s, I'm traveling through Europe, I'm traveling through South America, and they have street peddlers with nudie mags just out for everybody to see. And
yeah, but they're not as tight of, no yeah, pun intended, about sex over there.
It's not a big deal. And so I got back to the States, and I kind of had to relearn what was right and what was wrong.
Dexter's chewing on the cord to the mics.
Oh.
It's like, Dexter, stop it. Dexter's his cat. Who's chewing on the mic cord now, fighting with Scott over it. So we're going to say, don't forget to go to Amazon. Well, 1201beyond.com to use the Amazon links. You know what I mean.
There's also right there at 1201beyond.com, there is a donate button that Josh
which doesn't work. I've just been informed, so I will get Cassandra on that.
But if you do want to donate, PayPal, just go to paypal.com, and the email address they send money to is
1201beyond. I'm too used to the promo.
You're too stuck.
1201beyond@gmail.com.
Exactly. And you can tell us what you want that donation to go to. Oh, real quick.
Okay.
I hope we have time for this, because if we don't, goodbye, everybody. Thank you very much. If we do, come this November, Josh and I are going to try and get to a convention, a horror convention in Chicago.
The word try is operable.
Try is a big deal. And what we're asking for is for donations to cover our hotel costs there, to get down there.
Gas.
We've got some gas, food. We want to meet some fans down there, Marcy amongst them, and just enjoy the weekend of the horror con. Days of the Dead. Days of the Dead. It's in November in Chicago. We want to try and get down there. If you're willing, shoot us a few bucks. I was even thinking about doing a Kickstarter thing. We'll talk about that.
Yeah,
but,
we'll talk about that offline.
But nonetheless, shoot us a few bucks to get us to Chicago for this weekend con. And if you're in Chicago, you can meet us. And otherwise, hey, please, we could use the help. Thank you very much.
And that'll give us stories, too. So, all right, have a good night, guys.